local police departments who are operating in schools, which also has saved an additional almost $40 million to be invested in student, family, and community supports and restorative justice. So people aren't sitting back and doing nothing. There's a, in fact, this past week, a new website just launched called defundpolice.org. And I'd like to really point people who are interested in the idea of defunding the police to go to that website and find a map of all the different places around the country that are organizing still, because the demand is still defund to abolish. So I think that people really should pay attention to that and see that.
Well, Mariam Kaba, I want to thank you so much for being with us, longtime organizer and abolitionist. The new book, We Do This Till We Free Us, Abolitionist Organizing and Transforming Justice. In 10 seconds, why you chose that title, Mariam?
That's a chant that has been ringing out in the streets ever since 2014. In Ferguson and in New York and all around the country, I've seen and heard when I was in the streets with young people at protest, young people in Chicago screaming that.
We're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much. That does it for our broadcast. Wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, my friends. This is Life During Wartime.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 17th at 10 p.m. for Life During Wartime.
Not just a regular Life During Wartime, playing punk and hardcore, having live bands, and letting you know all the underground DIY punk happenings going on in the Portland metro area.
Just because we're different, they have a spaz attack.
This is a celebration marathon. It's from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. It's our 26th year on the air, so we're having a 25th anniversary celebration.
Looking back at the DJs and bands
Life During Wartime
that have made Life During Wartime a punk institution in Portland, at KBOO, and on the World Wide Web.
Celebrate 25 years of Life During Wartime by donating during our anniversary marathon celebration.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m.
Here on your community radio station.
KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, over 130,000 Oregonians are at risk of losing their unemployment benefits by mid-March. The Oregon Small Enterprise Relief Fund will distribute $10 million to immigrant-owned small businesses across the state. And Governor Brown announces a two-week reprieve before counties are moved back to the COVID extreme risk category. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 5th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. Over 130,000 Oregonians may lose their unemployment benefits when two federal programs expire in mid-March. Both the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program and the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program were part of the original CARES Act last spring and were extended in December, but both programs are set to expire on March 13th. The administration's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package contains extensions to these programs and increases the weekly amount from $300 to $400. Early this week, the package cleared the U.S. House of Representatives, but the Senate only took up debate on the bill yesterday. And the concern locally is that even if the bill passes, it won't happen in time to prevent a lapse in benefits. In a statement, Acting Oregon Employment Department head David Gerstenfeld said, quote, "Unfortunately, I don't see any realistic path where there isn't at least some pause in benefits for some people." He went on to say that even if it rolls out quickly, the state will have to wait for federal guidance, and it will take time to update and test the system. Two bills under consideration in the Oregon legislature could restrict recreational boaters on the Willamette River. Proponents of the measure say it will help protect habitat and improve onshore communities. Opponents of the bill say it has the potential to worsen safety and hurt small businesses. KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
Recreational boaters in the Newburgh Pool stretch of the Willamette River could face new restrictions come boating season. The Oregon legislature is considering two bills that would prohibit boats weighing more than 4,000 pounds from participating in towed water sports on the river. That includes tubing, water skiing, and wakeboarding. The new rule would impact about 30 miles of the Willamette River from Willamette Falls to the mouth of the Yamhill River. The Oregon State Marine Board says this is one of the highest use areas of the river, and it sees the greatest diversity of use. The stretch in question is also developed on both sides of the river. This has led to conflict in the area and legislative attempts to solve it. Josh Mulholland is the Environment and Policy Manager for the Oregon State Marine Board. He describes how issues in the Newburgh Pool have been tackled in the past.
In the 2019 legislative session, the legislature put a towed water sports education program in place for the Newburgh Pool. And that required anyone participating in wake surfing or wakeboarding to get an endorsement and take an education course, but it also required them to certify their boats for those activities. And as part of that, the weights of those boats had to be reported. So we do have information on the weights of boats being used currently for wake sports on the Newburgh Pool. There is just over 400 boats certified. The average weight of those is just over 5,000 pounds, and 4,000 pounds would restrict approximately 60% of those boats from participating in towed water sports on the Newburgh Pool.
The reduction was influenced by concerns about erosion in the riverbank, the safety of boaters, and dock damage for riverfront homeowners. Matt Radich is the president of Active Water Sports, a boat dealer in Oregon City. He's concerned that the two bills, House Bill 2555 and 2725, would hurt his business and actually reduce the safety of boaters.
It's going to have a huge impact on small business. Our boat sales are going to be drastically reduced because the majority of the new boats we sell don't fit that 4,000-pound weight restriction. And also, it will have a huge impact on safety. One of the things they're talking about is safety, but what it's going to do, it's going to drive, you know, the hundreds of boaters that recreate in that area to other, you know, whether it's Detroit Lake or Hag Lake or, you know, the downtown stretch of the river. It's going to push these people in other areas and lead to really overcrowding, which obviously is going to lead to safety issues in those other areas.
Radich is also with the group Oregon Families for Boating, which opposes the legislation. They say that the 4,000-pound weight limit as applied to towboats doesn't make sense.
The proponents of these bills, they kind of allude to the fact that there's been science and studies that say these boats are too big, but there is none. There's never been a study that determines, okay, what's an acceptable level of impact and what's not an acceptable level. 4,000 pounds is on the extreme side. The weight limit was actually set by the Marine Board. They did their research and they set that number at the weight limit at 10,000 pounds. And they're the agency that actually has put the time into looking at things. So why, after a year of that being in place, does it need to get changed again, and why all the way to 4,000 pounds? Also, the fact that they're going to put a weight limit on just one type of boat, like just towed sports boats need to weigh 4,000 pounds or less. Now, those boats don't make any different waves than a 4,000-pound fishing boat or 4,000-plus-pound cruiser. So why are these bills also just targeted at wake sports? That's another question we ask. If we're talking about erosion and property damage, those things, the bank doesn't care what kind of boat went by. Right now, it's almost a crusade against us that's not data-driven. It's emotionally driven by a small group of homeowners, river users that don't like wake sports. They don't like the, you know, whether it's the stereo from their boat, the attitude of the people.
The state legislature will hear public testimony on House Bills 2555 and 2725 virtually on Tuesday, March 9th. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
Legal cannabis sales soared to a record high in Oregon last year, coming in at well over $1 billion and generating over $100 million in tax revenue for the state. The state's school systems are the biggest recipient, receiving 40% of the money, with city and county governments getting a 10% share. Yesterday, the House Committee on Revenue met to discuss bills that might increase the take for city and county governments. House Bill 2014 would change how cannabis taxes are allocated to local governments, while House Bill 2015 would allow city or county governments to increase taxes from 3 to 10%. And while the prospect of increased tax revenue is appealing to local governments, some warned that the increase could prove counterproductive. A representative of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association warned that a tax increase might cause customers to source their weed from less expensive, illegal products, resulting in an overall reduction of tax revenue. Casey Houlihan of Orca said, quote, "Oregon remains a leader in illicit cannabis production and export. One only needs to do a Craigslist search for 420 or OMMP to see the ready availability of surplus products on secondary markets presently." Oregon Governor Kate Brown has announced a rule modification that gives counties an opportunity to avoid a return to the extreme risk level for COVID. Beginning next week, counties that have an increase in coronavirus cases that would place them in the extreme risk category will now have 2 weeks to bring their numbers down before being moved to the highest level. The objective is to give local officials and businesses an opportunity to bring the numbers down before facing the closures and other limitations that a designation of extreme risk imposes. During a Thursday press conference, Brown said, quote, "Recognizing the challenges businesses encounter when facing a switch back and forth between extreme risk and other risk levels, this two-week extension will alleviate some of those challenges and give counties a bit more time to bring case rates down." The rule change was greeted enthusiastically by business owners throughout the state. Jason Brandt is the president of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. He applauded the action, saying, quote, "We want to acknowledge the importance of this change and this response to our plea for changes." Currently, Benton, Coos, Douglas, Jefferson, and Josephine counties are listed as extreme risk. In Portland, Multnomah County is listed as high risk, while Clackamas and Washington counties have entered moderate risk. Yesterday, the Oregon Worker Relief Fund announced the establishment of a new program to support small business owners who have been impacted by the pandemic. The Oregon Small Enterprise Relief Fund will distribute $10 million to immigrant-owned small businesses across the state that have been unable to get aid through federal programs. The funds became available after the Oregon Legislature's Emergency Board appropriated $46 million in January to set up the new fund and provide continuing support of the Worker Relief Fund. To be eligible, businesses must have experienced a decline in revenue due to the pandemic, be actively operating in Oregon, and be at least partially owned by someone who uses an individual taxpayer identification number or equivalent to file their taxes. Those numbers are issued by the IRS to people who don't have Social Security numbers. Qualified business owners are eligible for grants ranging from $7,000 to $25,000. The Worker Relief Fund and a separate fund to support immigrants who have had to quarantine due to COVID-19 has distributed over $40 million since last April. Over 25,000 Oregonians who were otherwise unable to access federal aid due to their immigration status were helped. Last fall, the City of Portland created a $550,000 fund to help businesses replace broken windows and repair other damage resulting from the May 30th protests and the sharp increase in vandalism and burglaries since the start of the pandemic. The money helped about 150 businesses to recover, but the funds ran out long before all the damaged businesses could be assisted. So in December, hundreds of Portland business leaders formed the Rose City Downtown Collective to advocate for businesses in Center City. The group launched a crowdfunding site to help downtown business owners repair vandalism and replace broken windows. To date, they've raised over $22,000, allowing them to provide microgrants of $1,000 to 22 downtown businesses. The group is also raising additional money in a separate fund to help businesses clean up graffiti and has been working with the city to organize garbage cleanup. Some business owners think the mayor and city council aren't doing enough to help downtown businesses to recover. Others think the police and district attorney haven't done enough to arrest and prosecute people who have employed vandalism during protests. But Rose City Downtown Collective spokesperson Vanessa Sturgeon told the Oregonian that the problem is too big for the city or any one organization to deal with. She went on to say, quote, "We're hopeful that moving forward, we're going to find some solutions, but it's going to take a community-based effort." In January of 2020, the Central City Concern suddenly closed the Northeast Portland Sobering Station after 35 years. The nonprofit cited safety concerns for patients and staff who were dealing with an increasing number of patients in the midst of a mental health crisis or agitated by drugs. On Wednesday, the Portland City Council approved a $70,000 grant to partially replace the sobering station. The money will fund a project named the Behavioral Health Emergency Coordination Network. Currently, people having a mental health or drug-induced emergency are taken to the Psychiatric Emergency Service Center at the Unity Center for Behavioral Health in the Rose Quarter. But when the center is full, patients are sent to local emergency rooms, which were already crowded even prior to the COVID pandemic. The new project will take a hub and spoke approach to identify a support network where patients can be moved to a sobering center, an urgent care facility, or a psychiatric unit. In a statement of support, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "We need a more coordinated and integrated approach to providing meaningful care to people in crisis. We can do better by working together to create a more robust and coordinated network of support." You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, stick around for The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect a cloudy night with occasional rain and temperatures in the low to mid-40s. Tomorrow, we'll see a mostly cloudy day with a slight chance of passing showers and a high near 50. On this day in 1961, President John F. Kennedy signed an executive order establishing the Peace Corps. Today's quote is from the late Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, who said, quote, "It's better to send in the Peace Corps than the Marine Corps." California study called Follow the Money has found that the state underfunds community colleges where the majority of students are Black. In Washington state, a Senate bill has been introduced to increase community college access for people of color and low-income communities. For more on these stories, here's Suzanne Potter and Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service.
Two new reports highlight disparities in California colleges that put African-American students at a disadvantage. The study, Follow the Money, says California systematically underinvests in Black degree attainment, spending almost twice as much per student in the Cal State University or University of California systems than it does in community colleges, where 80% of Black students are enrolled. Dr. Edward Bush is co-founder of the group AMEND, which stands for African American Male Education Network and Development. He says the disparities are not accidental.
It's structural inequity. We have to look at this through the lens that perhaps that this is a manifestation of racist policies.
The report suggests more money for community colleges and an expansion of Cal grants to low-income community college students who are more likely than those at UC or CSU to be working at low-wage jobs or supporting a family. Both studies are from the Campaign for College Opportunity. The second, called The State of Higher Education for Black Californians, says while the four-year graduation rates for Black students at CSU has doubled in the past decade, it's still only 20%. It also finds 60% of Black high school graduates aren't prepared to meet the entrance requirements for UC or CSU. Bush says students of color often have a harder time getting into a four-year school.
So it simply cannot be couched in a conversation about class, because we know that poor white students will have a greater likelihood of attending the University of California or California State University system than lower income African American or Latino students.
The State of Higher Education report suggests making the classes needed to get into CSU and UC the default curriculum for all high school students in California. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A measure in Olympia could make Washington State's community and technical colleges more diverse. Senate Bill 5194 aims to increase access for people of color and low-income communities to promote racial equity in these schools. Isaac Chow is a student fellow with Communities of Our Colleges, which is supporting the bill. He says one of the provisions would increase mental health resources at community and technical colleges, which would help students who are struggling outside the classroom.
The whole idea here is just to really provide that support for students to be able to continue their education and really achieve their potential.
The bill also includes the Guided Pathway Program, which would help students navigate school from enrollment to graduation. Although the bill has no state capital budget cost, it would require colleges to spend money on planning. It's now in the Senate Rules Committee. Bills must pass out of their house of origin by Tuesday to stay alive in the legislature. The bill also would increase accessibility for undocumented students. Lizbeth Rivera Estrada is a student at Wenatchee Valley College and DACA recipient. She says one important provision would change residency requirements, which would be helpful for students who arrive in the state at the end of high school.
Previously, you had to have a three-year residency at Washington State to be able to apply to a community college and then get in-state tuition, which is a lot more affordable. And so this residency requirement would be changed to that of 1 year.
Both students say one of the most important parts of the bill would convert part-time professors into full-time faculty at community and technical colleges. Chow says students develop relationships with teachers who may not be around the next semester.
We really believe a strong investment into our faculty is a really strong investment into the students as well, and into the whole next generation of people who are going to be sort of helping move society forward.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Despite a joint review by Alaskan and British Columbian officials, tribes and fishers in BC remain concerned about the potential impact of mining activities on salmon habitats. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Officials in Alaska and Canada say they're done monitoring three transboundary watersheds, the study started by the previous state administration. Tribes and fishermen are concerned about possible British Columbia mining impacts on salmon habitat. Jacob Resnick reports.
It was Southeast Alaska tribes that helped spur the Walker administration to engage BC over transboundary mining. And they say the work has been short-lived. Fred Olson Jr. heads the 15-tribe Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission.
We definitely need water quality sampling, but we need ongoing, seasonal, sustainable sampling. We don't need a couple years of hit and miss, cherry-picking the data, and then saying everything's okay.
In 2015, Governor Walker signed a landmark agreement with British Columbia, pledging to study and monitor these transboundary watersheds that host a booming Canadian mining sector and Alaska's fisheries. That monitoring effort didn't get off the ground until 2017, and now Alaska and BC governments say their work is done. Greg Camblin heads BC's Environment Ministry's Regional Water Quality Section.
Because these established sampling programs in the region, continuation of the joint sampling program would really be redundant.
But scientists who've studied these watersheds say a couple of years is a blink of an eye for dynamic river systems. Chris Sargent is a freshwater ecologist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. The final report noted there was little evidence of contamination and aquatic life appeared healthy. But Sargent says many of the mines that Alaskans downstream are worried about haven't been built yet.
We have a lot of potential mines coming down the pike that are very large projects. They could be built in the near future. And so I'm looking at like, well, do we know what these metal patterns look like right now in these rivers in case those big projects are built and things change? And I just don't think we're set up for success to answer that question yet.
But Alaska and BC will still collaborate. Its bilateral working group established during the Walker administration will continue to meet twice a year. I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Alaska.
A bill making its way through Congress would permanently ban new uranium mining claims near Grand Canyon National Park. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports supporters of the legislation say uranium mining threatens the environment and public health.
The Grand Canyon Protection Act would make permanent a 20-year moratorium put in place by the Obama administration in 2012 on new uranium claims on more than a million acres surrounding the park. Environmental groups say mining threatens the seeps and springs of the Grand Canyon. Southwestern tribes have also long opposed uranium mining in the area. The Havasupai, who live in the canyon, worry it would threaten their sole water source. Navajo Nation leaders point to health problems among members and more than 500 abandoned uranium mines in the region left over from the Cold War. Arizona Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva is a sponsor of the bill in the U.S. House of Representatives.
The contamination that they suffered, both water, land, the cleanup that is still ongoing 50 years later, prenatal and natal health effects that have occurred, and the Navajo Nation, particularly the Navajo people, having suffered, the most out of the health consequences of it all. That's the legacy.
The House passed the bipartisan bill last week as part of a larger conservation package, and Arizona's two U.S. senators have introduced a Senate version. Arizona Republican Congressman Paul Gosar, however, calls the bill a land grab and an attack on the local economy. The uranium industry contends modern mining is safe and says limiting domestic production would make the U.S. more dependent on foreign sources. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Wisconsin Republican senator demanded that the entire 682-page pandemic aid bill be read aloud before voting could begin. The reading by Senate clerks took over 10 hours. Meanwhile, Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski voted with Democrats to approve the nomination of Deb Haaland as Secretary of the Interior to a full Senate vote. With more on those stories and others, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Section 2712, funding for pediatric mental health care access. Section 2713.
It was a long night in the Senate, where clerks tag-teamed to read the 628-page American Rescue Plan. Republican Senator Ron Johnson forced the delay, blocking Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's normal move to skip the reading.
Madam President.
Senator from Wisconsin.
Reserving the right to object.
You see a lamp.
Some Republicans questioned the bill's $1.9 trillion price tag, with Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma noting that the money is not budgeted.
If we're going to borrow $2 trillion and we don't even know that the previous money is unspent yet, why are we doing this? We're putting our nation at risk, a greater risk for economic damage, while we're trying to, quote unquote, save our nation.
Roughly 20 hours of debate are expected. A long list of amendments includes a possible $15 minimum wage back by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He points out the wage increase would come over 5 years.
Anyone who says we're raising the minimum wage in 1 year in the midst of a pandemic to $15 an hour is simply not telling the truth.
Despite the speed bump, Schumer said the chamber would stay in session to pass the relief bill. Deb Haaland's nomination for Interior Secretary is headed to the full Senate. Republican Lisa Murkowski joined Democrats in committee to vote for the New Mexico Congresswoman and Native American. Murkowski said she was guided by the wishes of Alaska Natives and other constituents.
They recognize that this is truly a historic nomination, and in doing so, they believe that Alaska Native issues can be elevated to one of the highest levels of government.
Meanwhile, Arkansas Republican Tom Cotton said he's blocking Merrick Garland's confirmation to head the Department of Justice, citing Garland's, quote, refusal to answer basic questions, unquote. With Neera Tanden out, some Democrats want Shalonda Young to serve as director of the Office of Management and Budget instead. Young is currently nominated as deputy director of the office and testified yesterday.
And if confirmed, I look forward to using my experience in these halls to ensure both branches operate with mutual respect and work towards solutions that will improve the lives of those we serve.
The Biden administration has not ruled Young out, but said it's looking at several possible candidates. And White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki pushed back against criticism of President Joe Biden's Neanderthal remarks regarding the behavior of Republican governors who lift mask mandates.
The behavior of a Neanderthal, just to be very clear, the behavior of.
Psaki noted the comment was a reflection of the president's frustration over people refusing to follow public health guidance to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote her first majority opinion yesterday on a case concerning the Freedom of Information Act. Barrett said the ruling will shield federal agencies from having to disclose certain materials under an exception to the law. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday,